Hawat nodded, thinking, perhaps I'm doing it, getting across to him the importance of this planet as an enemy. It's madness to go in there without that caution in our minds. Orr looked up at the skylight, aware that it had begun to rain. He saw the spreading wetness on the grey metaglass.
Water. You'll earn a great concern for water. As the Duke's son, you'll never want for it, but you'll see the pressures of thirst all around you.
Paul wet his lips with his tongue. Thinking back to the day a week ago and the ordeal with the Reverend Mother, she, too, had said something about water starvation. You'll learn about the funeral plains, she'd said, about the wilderness that is empty, the wasteland where nothing lives except the spice and the sandworms. You'll stain your eye-pits to reduce the sun glare. Shelter will mean a hollow out of the wind and hidden from view. You'll ride upon your own 2 feet without thopter or ground car or mount. And Paul had been caught more by her tone, sing-song and wavering, than by her words. When you live upon Arrakis, she had said, Chala, the land is empty. The moons will be your friends, the sun your enemy. Paul had sensed his mother come up beside him, away from her post guarding the door. She had looked at the Reverend Mother and asked, Do you see no hope, your reverence? Not for the father. And the old woman had waved Jessica to silence, looked down at Paul. Grave this on your memory, lad. A world is supported by 4 things. She held up 4 big knuckled fingers. The learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, and the valor of the brave. But all of these are as nothing. She closed her fingers into a fist. Without a ruler who knows the art of ruling, make that the science of your tradition. A week had passed since that day with the Reverend Mother. Her words were only now beginning to come into full register. Now, sitting in the training room with Thufir Hawat, Paul felt a sharp pang of fear. He looked across at the Mendhat's puzzled frown. He seems to be getting over it, Hawat thought. But that old witch frightened him. Why did she do it?
Thufir, will Arrakis be as bad as she said?
Nothing could be that bad.
Hawat forced a smile.
Take those Fremen, for example, the renegade people of the desert. By first approximation analysis, I can tell you there are many, many more of them than the Imperium suspects. People live there, lad, a great many people, and they hate Harkonnens with a bloody passion. You must not breathe a word of this, lad. I tell you only as your father's helper.
My father has told me of Seleucus Secundus. Do you know, Thufir, it sounds much like Arrakis. Perhaps not quite as bad, but much like it.
We do not really know of Seleucus Secundus today. Only what it was like long ago, mostly. But what is known, you're right on that score.
Will the Fremen help us?
It's a possibility.
Hawat stood up.
I leave today for Arrakis. Meanwhile, you take care of yourself for an old man who's fond of you, eh? Come round here like the good lad and sit facing the door. It's not that I think there's any danger in the castle. It's just a habit I want you to form.
Paul got to his feet, moved around the table.
You're going today?
Today it is. And you'll be following tomorrow. Next time we meet, it'll be on the soil of your new world.
He gripped Paul's right arm at the bicep.
Keep your knife arm free, eh? And your shield at full charge.
He released the arm, patted Paul's shoulder, whirled and strode quickly to the door.
Thufir!
Hawat turned, standing in the open doorway.
Don't sit with your back to any doors.
A grin spread across the seamed old face.
That I won't, lad. Depend on it.
And he was gone, shutting the door softly behind. Paul sat down where Hawat had been, straightened the papers. One more day here, he thought. He looked around the room. We're leaving. The idea of departure was suddenly more real to him than it had ever been before. He recalled another thing the old woman had said about a world being the sum of many things. The people, the dirt, the growing things, the moons, the tides, the suns. The unknown sum called nature, a vague summation without any sense of the now. And he wondered, what is the now? The door across from Hall banged open, and an ugly lump of a man lurched through it, preceded by a handful of weapons.
"Well, Gurney Halleck, are you the new weapons master?"
Halleck kicked the door shut with one heel.
"You'd rather I came to play games, I know."
He glanced around the room, noting that Howard's men had already been over it, checking, making it safe for a Duke's heir. The subtle code signs were all around. Paul watched the rolling, ugly man set himself back in motion, veer toward the training table with a load of weapons. Saw the 9-string baliset, slung over Gurney's shoulder with a multi-pick woven through the strings near the head of the fingerboard. Halleck dropped the weapons on the exercise table, lined them up. The rapiers, the bodkins, the kinjals, the slow pellet stunners, the shield belts. The ink-vine scar along his jawline writhed as he turned, casting a smile across the room.
"So you don't even have a good morning for me, you young imp. And what barb did you think in old Howard? He passed me in the hall like a man running to his enemy's funeral."
Paul grinned. Of all his father's men, he liked Gurney Halleck best. Knew the man's moods and deviltry, his humours, and thought of him more as a friend than as a hired sword. Halleck swung the baliset off his shoulder, began tuning it.
"If you won't talk, you won't."
Paul stood and advanced across the room.
"Well, Gurney, do we come prepared for music when it's fighting time?"
"So it's sass for our elders today."
Halleck tried a chord on the instrument, nodded.
"Where's Duncan Idaho? Isn't he supposed to be teaching me weaponry?"
"Duncan's gone to lead the second wave onto Arrakis. All you have left is poor Gurney, who's fresh out of fight and spoiling for music."
He struck another chord, listened to it, smiled.
"And it was decided in council that you being such a poor fighter, we'd best teach you the music trade so's you won't waste your life entire."
"Maybe you'd better sing me a lay then. I want to be sure how not to do it."
"Ah-ha."
Gurney laughed. And he swung into Galatian Girls, his multi-pick a blur over the strings as he sang. "Oh, the Galatian girls will do it for pearls and the Arricane for water, but if you desire dames like consuming flames, try a Caledonian daughter."
"Not bad for such a poor hand with the pick, but if my mother heard you singing a bawdy like that in the castle, she'd have your ears on the outer wall for decoration."
Gurney pulled at his left ear.
"Poor decoration, too, they having been bruised so much listening at keyholes while a young lad I know practiced some strange ditties on his baliset."
"So you've forgotten what it's like to find sand in your bed?"
Paul pulled a shield belt from the table, buckled it fast around his waist.
"Then let's fight!"
"So, it was your wicked hand did that deed. Guard yourself today, young master. Guard yourself."
He grabbed up a rapier, laced the air with it.
"I'm a hell fiend out for revenge."
Paul lifted the companion rapier, bent it in his hands, stood in the agile, 1 foot forward. He let his manner go solemn, in a comic imitation of Dr. Yui.
"What a dolt my father sends me for weaponry. This doltish Gurney Halleck has forgotten the first lesson for a fighting man armed and shielded."
Paul snapped the force button at his waist, felt the crinkled skin tingling of the defensive field at his forehead and down his back, heard external sounds take on characteristic shield-filtered flatness.
"In shield fighting, one moves fast on defense, slow on attack. Attack has the sole purpose of tricking the opponent into a misstep, setting him up for the attack sinister. The shield turns the fast blow, admits the slow kinjal."
Paul snapped up the rapier, feinted fast, and whipped it back for a slow thrust, timed to enter a shield's mindless defenses. Halleck watched the action, turned at the last minute to let the blunted blade pass his chest.
"Speed excellent?" but you were wide open for an underhanded counter with a slip tip.
Paul stepped back, chagrined.
I should whap your backside for such carelessness.
He lifted a naked Kinjal from the table and held it up.
This in the hand of an enemy can let out your life's blood. You're an apt pupil, none better, but I've warned you that not even in play do you let a man inside your guard with death in his hand.
I guess I'm not in the mood for it today.
Mood? What has mood to do with it? You fight when the necessity arises, no matter the mood. Mood's a thing for cattle or making love or playing the balisset. It's not for fighting.
I'm sorry, Gurney.
You're not sorry enough.
Haddock activated his own shield, crouched with Kinjal out thrust in left hand, the rapier poised high in his right.
Now I say guard yourself for true!
He leaped high to one side, then forward, pressing a furious attack. Paul fell back, parrying. He felt the field crackling as shield edges touched and repelled each other, sensed the electric tingling of the contact along his skin. What's gotten into Gurney? He asked himself. He's not faking this. Paul moved his left hand, dropped his bodkin into his palm from its wrist sheath.
You see a need for an extra blade, eh?
Is this betrayal? Paul wondered. Surely not Gurney. Across the room they fought, thrust and parry, feint and counterfeint. The air within their shield bubbles grew stale from the demands on it that the slow interchange along barrier edges could not replenish. With each new shield contact, the smell of ozone grew stronger. Paul continued to back, but now he directed his retreat toward the exercise table. If I can turn him beside the table, I'll show him a trick, Paul thought. One more step, Gurney. Halleck took the step. Paul directed a parry downward, turned, saw Halleck's rapier catch against the table's edge. Paul flung himself aside, thrust high with rapier, and came in across Halleck's neckline with the bodkin. He stopped the blade an inch from the jugular.
Is this what you seek?
Look down, lad.
Paul obeyed. Saw Halleck's Kinjal thrust under the table's edge, the tip almost touching Paul's groin.
We'd have joined each other in death. But I'll admit you fought some better when pressed to it. You seem to get the mood.
He grinned wolfishly, the ink vine scar rippling along his jaw.
The way you came at me, would you really have drawn my blood?
Halleck withdrew the Kinjal, straightened.
If you'd fought one whit beneath your abilities, I'd have scratched you a good one, a scar you'd remember. I'll not have my favorite pupil fall to the first hearkening tramp who happens along.
Paul deactivated his shield, leaned on the table to catch his breath.
I deserved that, Gurney. But it would have angered my father if you'd hurt me. I'll not have you punished for my failing.
As to that, it was my failing, too. And you needn't worry about a training scar, too. You're lucky you have so few. As to your father, the Duke would punish me only if I failed to make a first-class fighting man out of you. And I'd have been failing there if I hadn't explained the fallacy in this mood thing you've suddenly developed.
Paul straightened, slipped his bodkin back into its wrist sheath.
It's not exactly play we do here.
Paul nodded. He felt a sense of wonder at the uncharacteristic seriousness in Halleck's manner, the sobering intensity. He looked at the beet-colored ink-vine scar on the man's jaw, remembering the story of how it had been put there by Beast Raban in a Harkonnen slave pit on Geardy Prime, and Paul felt a sudden shame that he had doubted Halleck even for an instant. It occurred to Paul then that the making of Halleck's scar had been accompanied by pain, a pain as intense, perhaps, as that inflicted by a reverend mother. He thrust this thought aside. It chilled their world.
I guess I did hope for some play today. Things are so serious around here lately.
Halleck turned away to hide his emotions. Something burned in his eyes. There was pain in him. Like a blister, all that was left of some lost yesterday that time had pruned off him. How soon this child must assume his manhood, Halleck thought. How soon he must read that form within his mind, that contract of brutal caution to enter the necessary fact on the necessary line. Please list your next of kin. Alec spoke without turning.
I sense the play in you, lad, and I'd like nothing better than to join in it. But this no longer can be play. Tomorrow we go to Arrakis. Arrakis is real. The Harkonnens are real.
Paul touched his forehead with his rapier blade held vertical. Alec turned, saw the salute, and acknowledged it with a nod. He gestured to the practice dummy.
Now, we'll work on your timing. Let me see you catch that thing sinister. I'll control it from over here where I can have a full view of the action, and I warn you, I'll be trying new counters today. There's a warning you'd not get from a real enemy.
Paul stretched up on his toes to relieve his muscles. He felt solemn with a sudden realization that his life had become filled with swift changes. He crossed to the dummy, slapped the switch on its chest with his rapier tip, and felt the defensive field forcing his blade away.
On guard!
Alec called, and the dummy pressed the attack. Paul activated his shield, parried, and countered. Alec watched as he manipulated the controls. His mind seemed to be in two parts, one alert to the needs of the training fight, and the other wandering in fly buzz. I'm the well-trained fruit tree, he thought, full of well-trained feelings and abilities, and all of them grafted onto me, all bearing for someone else to pick. For some reason, he recalled his younger sister, her elfin face so clear in his mind. But she was dead now, in a pleasure house for Harkonnen troops. She had loved pansies. Or was it daisies? He couldn't remember. It bothered him that he couldn't remember. Paul countered a slow swing of the dummy, brought up his left hand en cretisse. The clever little devil, Alec thought, intent now on Paul's interweaving hand motions. He's been practicing and studying on his own. That's not Duncan's style, and it's certainly nothing I've taught him. This thought only added to Halleck's sadness. I'm infected by mood, he thought. And he began to wonder about Paul, if the boy ever listened fearfully to his pillow throbbing in the night. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets, he murmured. It was his mother's expression, and he always used it when he felt the blackness of tomorrow on him. Then he thought what an odd expression that was, to be taking to a planet that had never known seas or fishes.
U.E. Wellington, Standard 10,082 to 10,191, Medical Doctor of the Souk School, graduated Standard 10,112, married Juana Marcus, Bene Gesserit, Standard 10,092 to 10,186. Chiefly noted as betrayer of Duke Leto Atreides. CF Bibliography, Appendix 7, Imperial Conditioning and Betrayal, V. From Dictionary of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Although he heard Dr. Yue enter the training room, noting the stiff deliberation of the man's pace, Paul remained stretched out, face down on the exercise table where the masseurs had left him. He felt deliciously relaxed after the workout with Gurney Halleck.
"You do look comfortable," said Yue in his calm, high-pitched voice.
Paul raised his head, saw the man's stick figure standing several paces away, took in at a glance the wrinkled black clothing, the square block of a head with purple lips and drooping moustache, the diamond tattoo of Imperial Conditioning on his forehead, the long black hair caught in the Souk School's silver ring at the left shoulder.
"You'll be happy to hear we haven't time for regular lessons today," Yue said. "Your father will be along presently."
Paul sat up.
"However, I've arranged for you to have a film book viewer and several lessons during the crossing to Arrakis."
"Oh." Paul began pulling on his clothes. He felt excitement that his father would be coming. They had spent so little time together since the Emperor's command to take over the fief of Arrakis. Yue crossed to the L table, thinking, how the boy has filled out these past few months. Such a waste. Oh, such a sad waste. And he reminded himself, I must not falter.
What I do is done to be certain my Wanna can no longer be hurt by the Harkonnen beasts. Paul joined him at the table, buttoning his jacket. What'll I be studying on the way across? Ah, the tyrannic life forms of Arrakis. The planet seems to have opened its arms to certain tyrannic life forms. It's not clear how. I must seek out the planetary ecologist when we arrive, a Dr. Kynes, and offer my help in the investigation. And Yui thought, what am I saying? I play the hypocrite even with myself. Will there be something on the Fremen? Paul asked. The Fremen? Yui drummed his fingers on the table, caught Paul staring at the nervous motion, withdrew his hand. Maybe you have something on the whole Arrakeen population, Paul said. Yes, to be sure, Yui said. There are two general separations of the people. Fremen, they are one group, and the others are the people of the Graben, the Sink, and the Pan. There's some intermarriage, I'm told. The women of Pan and Sink villages prefer Fremen husbands. Their men prefer Fremen wives. They have a saying, polish comes from the cities, wisdom from the desert. Do you have pictures of them? I'll see what I can get you. The most interesting feature, of course, is their eyes. Totally blue, no whites in them. Mutation? No, it's linked to a saturation of the blood with melange. The Fremen must be brave to live at the edge of that desert. By all accounts, Yui said, they compose poems to their knives. Their women are as fierce as the men. Even Fremen children are violent and dangerous. You'll not be permitted to mingle with them, I dare say. Paul stared at Yui, finding in these few glimpses of the Fremen a power of words that caught his entire attention. What a people to win as allies! And the worms? Paul asked. What? I'd like to study more about the sandworms. Ah, to be sure. I've a film book on a small specimen, only 110 meters long and 22 meters in diameter. It was taken in the northern latitudes. Worms of more than 400 meters in length have been recorded by reliable witnesses, and there's reason to believe even larger ones exist. Paul glanced down at a conical projection chart of the northern Arrakeen latitudes spread on the table. The desert belt and south polar regions are marked uninhabitable. Is it the worms? And the storms? But any place can be made habitable. If it's economically feasible, Yui said. Arrakis has many costly perils. He smoothed his drooping moustache. Your father will be here soon. Before I go, I've a gift for you, something I came across in packing. He put an object on the table between them, black, oblong, no larger than the end of Paul's thumb. Paul looked at it. Yui noted how the boy did not reach for it and thought, how cautious he is. It's a very old orange Catholic Bible made for space travellers. Not a film book, but actually printed on filament paper. It has its own magnifier and electrostatic charge system. He picked it up, demonstrated. The book is held closed by the charge, which forces against spring-locked covers. You press the edge, thus, and the pages you've selected repel each other and the book opens. It's so small, but it has 1,800 pages. You press the edge thus and so, and the charge moves ahead one page at a time as you read. Never touch the actual pages with your fingers. The filament tissue is too delicate. He closed the book, handed it to Paul. Try it. Yui watched Paul work the page adjustment, thought, I salve my own conscience. I give him the surcease of religion before betraying him. Thus may I say to myself that he has gone where I cannot go. This must have been made before film books, Paul said. It's quite old. Let it be our secret, eh? Your parents might think it too valuable for one so young. And Yui thought, his mother would surely wonder at my motives. Well, Paul closed the book, held it in his hand. If it's so valuable. Indulge an old man's whim, Yui said. It was given to me when I was very young. And he thought, I must catch his mind as well as his cupidity. Open it to 467 Kalima, where it says, "From water does all life begin." There's a slight notch on the edge of the cover to mark the place. Paul felt the cover, detected two notches, one shallower than the other. He pressed the shallower one, and the book spread open on his palm, its magnifier sliding into place. "Read it aloud," Yui said. Paul wet his lips with his tongue, read, "Think you of the fact that a deaf person cannot hear? Then what deafness may we not all possess? What senses do we lack that we cannot see and cannot hear another world all around us? What is there around us that we cannot—" "Stop it!" Yui barked. Paul broke off, stared at him. Yui closed his eyes, fought to regain composure. "What perversity caused the book to open at my Wana's favourite passage?" He opened his eyes, saw Paul staring at him. "Is something wrong?" Paul asked. "I'm sorry," Yui said. "That was my dead wife's favourite passage. It's not the one I intended you to read. It brings up memories that are painful." "There are two notches," Paul said. "Of course," Yui thought. "Wana marked her passage. His fingers are more sensitive than mine and found her mark. It was an accident. No more." "You may find the book interesting," Yui said. "It has much historical truth in it, as well as good ethical philosophy." Paul looked down at the tiny book in his palm, such a small thing. Yet it contained a mystery. Something had happened while he read from it. He had felt something stir his terrible purpose. "Your father will be here any minute," Yui said. "Put the book away and read it at your leisure." Paul touched the edge of it as Yui had shown him. The book sealed itself. He slipped it into his tunic. For a moment there, when Yui had barked at him, Paul had feared the man would demand the book's return. "I thank you for the gift, Dr. Yui," Paul said, speaking formally. "It will be our secret. If there is a gift of favour you wish from me, please do not hesitate to ask." "I need for nothing," Yui said. And he thought, "Why do I stand here torturing myself? And torturing this poor lad, though he does not know it. Oi! Damn those Harkonnen beasts! Why did they choose me for their abomination?"
How do we approach the study of Muad'Dib's father? A man of surpassing warmth and surprising coldness was the Duke Leto Atreides. Yet many facts open the way to this Duke: his abiding love for his Bene Gesserit lady, the dreams he held for his son, the devotion with which men served him. You see him there, a man snared by destiny, a lonely figure with his light dimmed behind the glory of his son. Still, one must ask, what is the son but an extension of the father? From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries by the Princess Irulan.
Paul watched his father enter the training room, saw the guards take up stations outside. One of them closed the door. As always, Paul experienced a sense of presence in his father, someone totally here. The Duke was tall, olive-skinned. His thin face held harsh angles worn only by deep, grey eyes. He wore a black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast. A silvered shield belt with a patina of much use girded his narrow waist.
"Hard at work, son?"
He crossed to the L table, glanced at the papers on it, swept his gaze around the room and back to Paul. He felt tired, filled with the ache of not showing his fatigue. "I must use every opportunity to rest during the crossing to Arrakis," he thought. "There'll be no rest on Arrakis."
"Not very hard. Everything's so..."
"Yes. Well, tomorrow we leave. It'll be good to get settled in our new home. Put all this upset behind."
Paul nodded, suddenly overcome by memory of the Reverend Mother's words. For the father, nothing.
"Father, Will Arrakis be as dangerous as everyone says?
The Duke forced himself to the casual gesture, sat down on a corner of the table, smiled. A whole pattern of conversation welled up in his mind, the kind of thing he might use to dispel the vapors in his men before a battle. The pattern froze before it could be vocalized, confronted by the single thought, "This is my son."
It'll be dangerous.
Howard tells me we have a plan for the Fremen.
Paul wondered, why don't I tell him what that old woman said? How did she seal my tongue? The Duke noted his son's distress.
As always, Hawat sees the main chance, but there's much more. I see also the Combine Onet Ober Advancer Mercantile, the Chome Company. By giving me Arrakis, His Majesty is forced to give us a Chome directorship. A subtle gain.
Chome controls the spice.
And Arrakis, with its spice, is our avenue into Chome. There's more to Chome than melange.
Did the Reverend Mother warn you?
Paul clenched his fists, feeling his palms slippery with perspiration. The effort it had taken to ask that question.
Hawat tells me she frightened you with warnings about Arrakis. Don't let a woman's fears cloud your mind. No woman wants her loved ones endangered. The hand behind those warnings was your mother's. Take this as a sign of her love for us.
Does she know about the Fremen?
Yes. And about much more.
What?
And the Duke thought, the truth could be worse than he imagines. But even dangerous facts are valuable, if you've been trained to deal with them. And there's one place where nothing has been spared for my son. Dealing with dangerous facts. This must be leavened, though. He is young.
Few products escape the Chome touch. Logs, donkeys, horses, cows, lumber, dung, sharks, whale fur. The most prosaic and the most exotic. Even our poor pundi rice from Caladan. Anything the guild will transport. The art forms of Ikaz, the machines of Richesi and Ix. But all fades before melange. A handful of spice will buy a home on Tupoli. It cannot be manufactured. It must be mined on Arrakis. It is unique, and it has true geriatric properties.
And now we control it.
To a certain degree. But the important thing is to consider all the houses that depend on Chome profits. And think of the enormous proportion of those profits dependent upon a single product. The spice. Imagine what would happen if something should reduce spice production.
Whoever had stockpiled melange could make a killing.
Others would be out in the cold.
The Duke permitted himself a moment of grim satisfaction, looking at his son and thinking how penetrating, how truly educated that observation had been. He nodded.
The Harkonnens have been stockpiling for more than 20 years.
They mean spice production to fail and you to be blamed.
They wish the Atreides' name to become unpopular. Think of the Landsrod houses that look to me for a certain amount of leadership. Their unofficial spokesman. Think how they'd react if I were responsible for a serious reduction in their income. After all, one's own profits come first. The great convention be damned. You can't let someone pauperize you.
A harsh smile twisted the Duke's mouth.
They'd look the other way, no matter what was done to me.
Even if we were attacked with atomics?
Nothing that flagrant. No open defiance of the convention, but almost anything else short of that. Perhaps even dusting and a bit of soil poisoning.
Then why are we walking into this?
Paul, knowing where the trap is, that's the first step in evading it. This is like single combat, son, only on a larger scale. A feint within a feint within a feint, seemingly without end. The task is to unravel it. Knowing that the Harkonnens stockpile melange, we ask another question. Who else is stockpiling? That's the list of our enemies.
Who?
Certain houses we knew were unfriendly, and some we'd thought friendly. We need not consider them for the moment, because there is one other much more important. Our beloved Padishah Emperor.
Paul tried to swallow in a throat suddenly dry.
Couldn't you convene the Landsraad? Expose...
Make our enemy aware we know which hand holds the knife? Ah, now, Paul, we see the knife now. Who knows where it might be shifted next? If we put this before the Landsraad, it'd only create a great cloud of confusion. The Emperor would deny it. Who could gainsay him? All we'd gain is a little time while risking chaos. And where would the next attack come from?
All the houses might start stockpiling spice.
Our enemies have a head start. Too much of a lead to overcome.
The Emperor. That means the Sardaukar.
Disguised in Harkonnen livery, no doubt. But the soldier fanatics, nonetheless.
How can Fremen help us against Sardaukar?
Did Hawat talk to you about Seleucus Secundus?
The Emperor's prison planet? No.
What if it were more than a prison planet, Paul? There's a question you never hear asked about the Imperial Corps of Sardaukar. Where do they come from?
From the prison planet.
They come from somewhere.
But the supporting levies the Emperor demands from...
That's what we're led to believe. They're just the Emperor's levies, trained young and superbly. You hear an occasional muttering about the Emperor's training cadres, but the balance of our civilization remains the same. The military forces of the Landsraad great houses on one side, the Sardaukar and their supporting levies on the other. And their supporting levies, Paul. The Sardaukar remain the Sardaukar.
But every report on Seleucus Secundus says SS is a hell world.
Undoubtedly. But if you are going to raise tough, strong, ferocious men, what environmental conditions would you impose on them?
How could you win the loyalty of such men?
There are proven ways. Play on the certain knowledge of their superiority, the mystique of secret covenant, the esprit of shared suffering. It can be done. It has been done on many worlds in many times.
Paul nodded, holding his attention on his father's face. He felt some revelation impending.
Consider Arrakis. When you get outside the towns and garrison villages, it's every bit as terrible a place as Seleucus Secundus.
Paul's eyes went wide.
The Fremen!
We have there the potential of a core as strong and deadly as the Sardaukar. It'll require patience to exploit them secretly and wealth to equip them properly. But the Fremen are there, and the spice wealth is there. You see now why we walk into Arrakis, knowing the trap is there.
Don't the Harkonnens know about the Fremen?
The Harkonnens sneered at the Fremen, hunted them for sport, never even bothered trying to count them. We know the Harkonnen policy with planetary populations. Spend as little as possible to maintain them.
The metallic threads in the hawk symbol above his father's breast glistened as the Duke shifted his position.
You see?
We're negotiating with the Fremen right now.
I sent a mission headed by Duncan Idaho. A proud and ruthless man, Duncan, but fond of the truth. I think the Fremen will admire him. If we're lucky, they may judge us by him. Duncan, the moral.
Duncan, the moral, and Gurney, the valorous.
You name them well.
And Paul thought, Gurney's one of those the Reverend Mother meant, a supporter of worlds, the valor of the brave.
Gurney tells me you did well in weapons today.
That isn't what he told me.
I figured Gurney to be sparse with his praise. He says you have a nicety of awareness, in his own words, of the difference between a blade's edge and its tip.
Gurney says there's no artistry in killing with the tip, that it should be done with the edge.
Gurney's a romantic. I'd sooner you never had to kill. But if the need arises, you do it however you can. Tip or edge.
The Duke looked up at the skylight, on which the rain was drumming. Seeing the direction of his father's stare, Paul thought of the wet skies out there, a thing never to be seen on Arrakis from all accounts, and this thought of skies put him in mind of the space beyond.
Are the guild ships really big?
The Duke looked at him.
This will be your first time off planet. Yes, they're big. We'll be riding a Highliner because it's a long trip. A Highliner is truly big. Its hold will tuck all our frigates and transports into a little corner. We'll be just a small part of the ship's manifest.
And we won't be able to leave our frigates.
That's part of the price you pay for guild security. There could be Harkonnen ships right alongside us, and we'd have nothing to fear from them. The Harkonnens know better than to endanger their shipping privileges.
I'm going to watch our screens and try to see a guildsman.
You won't. Not even their agents ever see a guildsman. The guild's as jealous of its privacy as it is of its monopoly. Don't do anything to endanger our shipping privileges, Paul.
Do you think they hide because they've mutated and don't look human anymore?
Who knows? It's a mystery we're not likely to solve. We've more immediate problems. Among them, you.
Me?
Your mother wanted me to be the one to tell you, son. You see, you may have Mentat capabilities.
Paul stared at his father, unable to speak for a moment. Then...
A Mentat? Me? But I...
Hawat agrees, son. It's true.
But I thought Mentat training had to start during infancy and the subject couldn't be told because it might inhibit the early...
Paul broke off, all his past circumstances coming to focus in one flashing computation.
I see.
A day comes when the potential Mentat must learn what's being done. It may no longer be done to him. The Mentat has to share in the choice of whether to continue or abandon the training. Some can continue. Some are incapable of it. Only the potential Mentat can tell this for sure about himself.
Paul rubbed his chin. All the special training from Hawat and his mother, the mnemonics, the focusing of awareness, the muscle control and sharpening of sensitivities, the study of languages and nuances of voices, all of it clicked into a new kind of understanding in his mind.
You'll be the Duke someday, son. A Mentat Duke would be formidable indeed. Can you decide now, or do you need more time?
I'll go on with the training.
Formidable indeed.
Paul saw the proud smile on his father's face. The smile shocked Paul. It had a skull look on the Duke's narrow features. Paul closed his eyes, feeling the terrible purpose reawaken within him. Perhaps being a Mentat is terrible purpose, he thought. But even as he focused on this thought, his new awareness denied it.
With the Lady Jessica and Arrakis, the Bene Gesserit system of sowing implant legends through the Missionaria Protectiva came to its full fruition. The wisdom of seeding the known universe with a prophecy pattern for the protection of Bene Gesserit personnel has long been appreciated, but never have we seen a condition ut extremis with more ideal mating of person and preparation. The prophetic legends had taken on Arrakis, even to the extent of adopted labels, including Reverend Mother, Canto and Respondu, and most of the Sharia Panopia Propheticus. And it is generally accepted now that the Lady Jessica's latent abilities were grossly underestimated. From Analysis, The Erekine Crisis, by the Princess Irulan, Private Circulation Bene Gesserit, File Number AR81088587.
All around the Lady Jessica, piled in corners of the Arrakeen Great Hall, mounded in the open spaces, stood the packaged freight of their lives. Boxes, trunks, cartons, cases, some partly unpacked. She could hear the cargo handlers from the guild shuttle depositing another load in the entry. Jessica stood in the center of the hall. She moved in a slow turn, looking up and around at shadowed carvings, crannies, and deeply recessed windows. This giant anachronism of a room reminded her of the sisters' hall at her Bene Gesserit school. But at the school, the effect had been of warmth. Here, all was bleak stone. Some architect had reached far back into history for these buttressed walls and dark hangings, she thought. The arched ceiling stood two stories above her, with great cross-beams she felt sure had been shipped here to Arrakis across space at monstrous cost. No planet of this system grew trees to make such beams, unless the beams were imitation wood. She thought not. This had been the government mansion in the days of the old empire. Costs had been of less importance then. It had been before the Harkonnens and their new megalopolis of Carthag, a cheap and brassy place some 200 kilometres northeast across the broken land. Leto had been wise to choose this place for his seat of government. The name, Arrakeen, had a good sound, filled with tradition. And this was a smaller city, easier to sterilize and defend. Again there came the clatter of boxes being unloaded in the entry. Jessica sighed. Against a carton to her right stood the painting of the Duke's father. Wrapping twine hung from it like a frayed decoration. A piece of the twine was still clutched in Jessica's left hand. Beside the painting lay a black bull's head mounted on a polished board. The head was a dark island in a sea of wadded paper. Its plaque lay flat on the floor, and the bull's shiny muzzle pointed at the ceiling, as though the beast were ready to bellow a challenge into this echoing room. Jessica wondered what compulsion had brought her to uncover those two things first, the head and the painting. She knew there was something symbolic in the action. Not since the day when the Duke's buyers had taken her from the school had she felt this frightened and unsure of herself. The head and the picture. They heightened her feelings of confusion. She shuddered, glanced at the slit windows high overhead. It was still early afternoon here, and in these latitudes the sky looked black and cold, so much darker than the warm blue of Caladan. A pang of homesickness throbbed through her. So far away, Caladan.
Here we are.
The voice was Duke Leto's. She whirled, saw him striding from the arched passage to the dining hall. His black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast looked dusty and rumpled.
I thought you might have lost yourself in this hideous place.
It is a cold house.
She looked at his tallness, at the dark skin that made her think of olive groves and golden sun on blue waters. There was wood smoke in the grey of his eyes, but the face was predatory, thin, full of sharp angles and planes. A sudden fear of him tightened her breast. He had become such a savage, driving person since the decision to bow to the Emperor's command.
The whole city feels cold.
It's a dirty, dusty little garrison town. But we'll change that. These are public rooms for state occasions. I've just glanced at some of the family apartments in the south wing. They're much nicer.
He stepped closer, touched her arm, admiring her stateliness. And again he wondered at her unknown ancestry. A renegade house, perhaps? Some black-barred royalty? She looked more regal than the Emperor's own blood. Under the pressure of his stare, she turned half away, exposing her profile, and he realized there was no single and precise thing that brought her beauty to focus. The face was oval under a cap of hair the color of polished bronze. Her eyes were set wide, as green and clear as the morning skies of Caladan. The nose was small, the mouth wide and generous. Her figure was good, but scant, tall and with its curves gone to slimness. He remembered that the lay sisters at the school had called her skinny, so his buyers had told him. But that description oversimplified. She had brought a regal beauty back into the Atreides line. He was glad that Paul favored her.
Where's Paul?
Someplace around the house, taking his lessons with Yui.
Probably in the south wing. I thought I heard Yui's voice, but I couldn't take time to look. I came here only to hang the key of Caladan Castle in the dining hall.
Jessica caught her breath, stopped the impulse to reach out to him. Hanging the key. There was finality in that action. But this was not the time or place for comforting.
I saw our banner over the house as we came in.
He glanced at the painting of his father.
Where were you going to hang that?
Somewhere in here.
No.
The word rang flat and final, telling her she could use trickery to persuade, but open argument was useless. Still, she had to try, even if the gesture served only to remind herself that she would not trick him.
My lord, if you'd only...
The answer remains no. I indulge you shamefully in most things, not in this. I've just come from the dining hall where there are...
My lord, please.
The choice is between your digestion and my ancestral dignity, my dear. They will hang in the dining hall.
Yes, my lord.
You may resume your custom of dining in your rooms whenever possible. I shall expect you at your proper position only on formal occasions.
Thank you, my lord.
And don't go all cold and formal on me. Be thankful that I never married you, my dear. Then it'd be your duty to join me at table for every meal.
She held her face immobile, nodded.
Awad already has our own poison snooper over the dining table. There's a portable in your room.
You anticipated this disagreement?
My dear, I think also of your comfort. I've engaged servants. They're locals, but Hawat has cleared them. They're Fremen all. They'll do until our own people can be released from their other duties.
Can anyone from this place be truly safe?
Anyone who hates Harkonnens. You may even want to keep the head housekeeper. The Shadout Mapes.
Shadout. A Fremen title.
I'm told it means Well Dipper. A meaning with rather important overtones here. She may not strike you as a servant type, although Hawat speaks highly of her on the basis of Duncan's report. They're convinced she wants to serve. Specifically, that she wants to serve you.
Me?
The Fremen have learned that you're Bene Gesserit. There are legends here about the Bene Gesserit.
The Missionaria Protectiva, Jessica thought. No place escapes them.
Does this mean Duncan was successful? Will the Fremen be our allies?
There's nothing definite. They wish to observe us for a while, Duncan believes. They did, however, promise to stop raiding our outlying villages during a truce period. That's a more important gain than it might seem. Hawat tells me the Fremen were a deep thorn in the Harkonnen side, that the extent of their ravages was a carefully guarded secret. It wouldn't have helped for the Emperor to learn the ineffectiveness of the Harkonnen military.
A Fremen housekeeper. She'll have the all-blue eyes.
Don't let the appearance of these people deceive you. There's a deep strength and healthy vitality in them. I think they'll be everything we need.
It's a dangerous gamble.
Let's not go into that again.
We are committed, no doubt of that.
Jessica went through the quick regimen of calmness, the two deep breaths, the ritual thought.
When I assign rooms, is there anything special I should reserve for you?
You must teach me someday how you do that. The way you thrust your worries aside and turn to practical matters. It must be a Bene Gesserit thing.
It's a female thing.
Well, assignment of rooms. Make certain I have large office space next to my sleeping quarters. There'll be more paperwork here than on Caladan. A guard room, of course. That should cover it. Don't worry about security of the house. Hawat's men have been over it in depth.
I'm sure they have.
The Duke glanced at his wristwatch.
And you might see that all our timepieces are adjusted for Erekine Local. I've assigned a tech to take care of it. He'll be along presently.
He brushed a strand of her hair back from her forehead.
I must return to the landing field now. The second shuttle's due any minute with my staff reserves.
Couldn't Hawat meet them, my lord? You look so tired.
The good Thufir is even busier than I am. You know this planet's infested with Harkonnen intrigues. Besides, I must try persuading some of the trained spice hunters against leaving. They have the option, you know, with the change of fief. And this planetologist the Emperor and the Landsrod installed as judge of the change cannot be bought. He's allowing the opt. About 800 trained hands expect to go out on the spice shuttle, and there's a guild cargo ship standing by.
My lord.
Yes?
He will not be persuaded against trying to make this planet secure for us, she thought. And I cannot use my tricks on him.
At what time will you be expecting dinner?
That's not what she was going to say, he thought. Ah, my Jessica. Would that we were somewhere else, anywhere away from this terrible place. Alone, the two of us, without a care.
I'll eat in the officer's mess at the field. Don't expect me until very late. And, I'll be sending a guard car for Paul. I want him to attend our strategy conference.
He cleared his throat as though to say something else, then, without warning, turned and strode out, headed for the entry where she could hear more boxes being deposited. His voice sounded once from there, commanding and disdainful, the way he always spoke to servants when he was in a hurry.
The Lady Jessica's in the Great Hall. Join her there immediately.
The outer door slammed. Jessica turned away, faced the painting of Leto's father. It had been done by the famed artist Alba during the old Duke's middle years. He was portrayed in matador costume with a magenta cape flung over his left arm. The face looked young, hardly older than Leto's now, and with the same hawk features, the same grey stare. She clenched her fists at her sides, glared at the painting.
Damn you, damn you, damn you!
What are your orders, noble-born?
Jessica whirled, stared down at a knobby, grey-haired woman in a shapeless sack dress of bondsman brown. The woman looked as wrinkled and desiccated as any member of the mob that had greeted them along the way from the landing field that morning. Every native she had seen on this planet, Jessica thought, looked prune dry and undernourished. Yet, Leto had said they were strong and vital. And there were the eyes, of course, that wash of deepest, darkest blue without any white, secretive, mysterious. Jessica forced herself not to stare. The woman gave a stiff-necked nod.
I am called the Shadowed Mapes, noble-born. What are your orders?
You may refer to me as my lady. I'm not noble-born. I'm the bound concubine of the Duke Leto.
Again, that strange nod. And the woman peered upward at Jessica with a sly questioning.
There's a wife, then?
There is not, nor has there ever been. I am the Duke's only companion. The mother of his heir designate.
Even as she spoke, Jessica laughed inwardly at the pride behind her words. What was it St. Augustine said? She asked herself. The mind commands the body and it obeys. The mind orders itself and meets resistance. Yes, I am meeting more resistance lately. I could use a quiet retreat by myself. A weird cry sounded from the road outside the house. It was repeated.
Sususuk! Sususuk!
Then,
Ikute! Ikute!
And then,
Sususuk!
What is that? I heard it several times as we drove through the streets this morning.
Only a water cellar, m'lady. But you've no need to interest yourself in such as they. The cistern here holds 50,000 liters, and it's always kept full. Why, you know, my lady, I don't even have to wear my still suit here. And me, not even dead.
Jessica hesitated, wanting to question this Fremen woman, needing data to guide her. But bringing order to the confusion in the castle was more imperative. Still, she found the thought unsettling that water was a major mark of wealth here.
My husband told me of your title, Shadout. I recognized the word. It's a very ancient word.
You know the ancient tongues, then?
Tongues are the Bene Gesserit's first learning. I know the Botani Jeeb and the Chakopsa, all the hunting languages.
Just as the legend says.
Jessica wondered, why do I play out this sham? But the Bene Gesserit ways were devious and compelling.
I know the dark things and the ways of the Great Mother.
She read the more obvious signs in Mapes's actions and appearance, the petty betrayals.
Misesis pregia, andral tu repera. Trada cic puscacri, misesis peracri.
Mapes took a backward step, appeared poised to flee.
I know many things. I know that you have borne children, that you have lost loved ones, that you have hidden in fear, and that you have done violence, and will yet do more violence. I know many things.
I meant no offense, my lady.
You speak of the legend and seek answers. Beware the answers you may find. I know you came prepared for violence with a weapon in your bodice.
My lady, I...
There's a remote possibility you could draw my life's blood. But in so doing, you'd bring down more ruin than your wildest fears could imagine. There are worse things than dying, you know. Even for an entire people.
My lady...
Mapes appeared about to fall to her knees.
The weapon was sent as a gift to you, should you prove to be the one.
And as the means of my death, should I prove otherwise.
Jessica waited in the seeming relaxation that made the Bene Gesserit training so terrifying in combat. Now we see which way the decision tips, she thought. Slowly, Mapes reached into the neck of her dress, brought out a dark sheath. A black handle with deep finger ridges protruded from it. She took sheath in one hand and handle in the other, withdrew a milk-white blade, held it up. The blade seemed to shine and glitter with a light of its own. It was double-edged, like a kinjal, and the blade was perhaps 20 centimeters long.
Do you know this, my lady?
It could only be one thing, Jessica knew. The fabled Chris-knife of Arrakis, the blade that had never been taken off the planet and was known only by rumor and wild gossip.
It's a Chris-knife.
Say it not lightly. Do you know its meaning?
And Jessica thought. There was an edge to that question. Here's the reason this Fremen has taken service with me, to ask that one question. My answer could precipitate violence or... what? She seeks an answer from me, the meaning of a knife. She's called the Shadout in the Chakopsa language. Knife, that's Deathmaker in Chakopsa. She's getting restive. I must answer now. Delay is as dangerous as the wrong answer.
It's a maker.
It was a sound of both grief and elation. She trembled so hard the knife blade sent glittering shards of reflection shooting around the room. Jessica waited, poised. She had intended to say the knife was a maker of death, and then add the ancient word, but every sense warned her now. All the deep training of alertness that exposed meaning in the most casual muscle twitch. The key word was maker. Maker? Maker. Still, Mapes held the knife as though ready to use it.
Did you think that I, knowing the mysteries of the Great Mother, would not know the Maker?
Mapes lowered the knife.
My lady, when one has lived with prophecy for so long, the moment of revelation is a shock.
Jessica thought about the prophecy, the Shari'ar and the Panoplia Propheticus. A Bene Gesserit of the Missionaria Protectiva, dropped here long centuries ago. Long dead, no doubt, but her purpose accomplished. The protective legends implanted in these people against the day of a Bene Gesserit's need. Well, that day had come. Mapes returned knife to sheath.
This is an unfixed blade, my lady. Keep it near you. More than a week away from flesh, and it begins to disintegrate. It's yours, a tooth of Shai Halud, for as long as you live.
Jessica reached out her right hand, risked a gamble.
Mapes, you've sheathed that blade unblooded.
With a gasp, Mapes dropped the sheathed knife into Jessica's hand, tore open the brown bodice.
Take the water of my life!
Jessica withdrew the blade from its sheath. How it glittered! She directed the point toward Mapes, saw a fear greater than death, panic come over the woman. Poison in the point? Jessica wondered. She tipped up the point, drew a delicate scratch with the blade's edge above Mapes's left breast. There was a thick welling of blood that stopped almost immediately. Ultra-fast coagulation, Jessica thought. A moisture-conserving mutation. She sheathed the blade.
Button your dress, Mapes.
Mapes obeyed, trembling. The eyes without whites stared at Jessica.
You are ours. You are the one.
There came another sound of unloading in the entry. Swiftly, Mapes grabbed the sheathed knife, concealed it in Jessica's bodice.
Who sees that knife must be cleansed or slain. You know that, m'lady.
I know it now, Jessica thought. The cargo handlers left without intruding on the great hall.
The uncleansed who have seen a Chris knife may not leave Arrakis alive. Never forget that, my lady. You've been entrusted with a Chris knife. Now the thing must take its course. It cannot be hurried.
She glanced at the stacked boxes and piled goods around them.
And there's work aplenty to while the time for us here.
Jessica hesitated. The thing must take its course. That was a specific catchphrase from the Missionaria Protectiva's stock of incantations. The coming of the Reverend Mother to free you. But I'm not a Reverend Mother, Jessica thought. And then, Great Mother, they planted that one here. This must be a hideous place.
What'll you be wanting me to do first, m'lady?
Instinct warned Jessica to match that casual tone.
The painting of the old Duke over there. It must be hung on one side of the dining hall. The bull's head must go on the wall opposite the painting.
Mapes crossed to the bull's head.
What a great beast it must have been to carry such a head. I'll have to be cleaning this first, won't I, m'lady?
No.
But there's dirt caked on its horns.
That's not dirt, Mapes. That's the blood of our Duke's father. Those horns were sprayed with a transparent fixative within hours after this beast killed the old Duke.
Ah, now!
It's just blood. Old blood at that. Get some help hanging these now. The beastly things are heavy.
Did you think the blood bothered me? I'm of the desert, and I've seen blood aplenty.
I see that you have.
And some of it my own. More than you drew with your puny scratch.
You'd rather I'd cut deeper.
Ah, no! The body's water is scant enough, thou'rt gushing a wasteful lot of it into the air. You did the thing right.
And Jessica, noting the words and manner, caught the deeper implications in the phrase, the body's water. Again she felt a sense of oppression at the importance of water on Arrakis.
On which side of the dining hall shall I hang which one of these pretties, m'lady?
Ever the practical one, this Mapes, Jessica thought.
Use your own judgment, Mapes. It makes no real difference.
As you say, m'lady.
Mapes stooped, began clearing wrappings and twine from the head.
Killed an old duke, did you?
Shall I summon a handler to help you?
I'll manage, m'lady.
Yes, she'll manage, Jessica thought. There's that about this Fremen creature, the drive to manage. Jessica felt the cold sheath of the Chris knife beneath her bodice, thought of the long chain of Bene Gesserit's scheming that had forged another link here. Because of that scheming, she had survived a deadly crisis. It cannot be hurried, Mapes had said. Yet there was a tempo of headlong rushing to this place that filled Jessica with foreboding. And not all the preparations of the Missionaria Protectiva, nor Howard's suspicious inspection of this castellated pile of rocks, could dispel the feeling.
When you've finished hanging those, start unpacking the boxes. One of the cargo men at the entry has all the keys and knows where things should go. Get the keys and the list from him. If there are any questions, I'll be in the south wing.
As you will, m'lady.
Jessica turned away, thinking, Hawat may have passed this residency as safe, but there's something wrong about the place. I can feel it. An urgent need to see her son gripped Jessica. She began walking toward the arched doorway that led into the passage to the dining hall and the family wings. Faster and faster she walked until she was almost running. Behind her, Mapes paused in clearing the wrappings from the bull's head, looked at the retreating back.
She's the one, all right. Poor thing.
Yui, 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 goes the refrain. A million deaths were not enough for Yui. From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
The door stood ajar, and Jessica stepped through into a room with yellow walls. To her left stretched a low settee of black hide and two empty bookcases, a hanging water flask with dust on its bulging sides. To her right, bracketing another door, stood more empty bookcases, a desk from Caladan, and three chairs. At the windows directly ahead of her stood Dr. Yue, his back to her, his attention fixed upon the outside world. Jessica took another silent step into the room. She saw that Yue's coat was wrinkled, a white smudge near the left elbow as though he had leaned against chalk. He looked, from behind, like a fleshless stick figure in overlarge black clothing, a caricature poised for stringy movement at the direction of a puppet master. Only the squarish block of head, with long ebony hair caught in its silver Sook school ring at the shoulder, seemed alive, turning slightly to follow some movement outside. Again she glanced around the room, seeing no sign of her son, but the closed door on her right, she knew, led into a small bedroom for which Paul had expressed a liking.
Good afternoon, Dr. Yui. Where's Paul?
He nodded as though to something out the window, spoke in an absent manner, without turning.
Your son grew tired, Jessica. I sent him into the next room to rest.
Abruptly he stiffened, whirled, with mustache flopping over his purpled lips.
Forgive me, my lady. My thoughts were far away. I did not mean to be familiar.
She smiled, held out her right hand. For a moment she was afraid he might kneel.
Wellington, please.
To use your name like that, I...
We've known each other 6 years. It's long past time formalities should have been dropped between us, in private.
Yui ventured a thin smile, thinking, I believe it has worked. Now she'll think anything unusual in my manner is due to embarrassment. She'll not look for deeper reasons when she believes she already knows the answer.
I'm afraid I was wool-gathering. Whenever I feel especially sorry for you, I'm afraid I think of you as, well, Jessica.
Sorry for me, whatever for.
Yui shrugged. Long ago he had realized Jessica was not gifted with a full truth-say as his Wana had been. Still, he always used the truth with Jessica whenever possible. It was safest.
You've seen this place, my Jessica. So barren after Caladan. And the people. Those townswomen we passed on the way here, wailing beneath their veils, the way they looked at us.
She folded her arms across her breast, hugging herself, feeling the kris-knife there, a blade ground from a sandworm's tooth, if the reports were right.
It's just that we're strange to them. Different people, different customs. They've known only the Harkonnens.
She looked past him out the windows.
What were you staring at out there?
The people.
Jessica crossed to his side, looked to the left toward the front of the house where Yui's attention was focused. A line of 20 palm trees grew there. The ground beneath them swept clean, barren. A screen fence separated them from the road upon which robed people were passing. Jessica detected a faint shimmering in the air between her and the people, a house shield, and went on to study the passing throng, wondering why Yui found them so absorbing. The pattern emerged, and she put a hand to her cheek. The way the passing people looked at the palm trees. She saw envy, some hate, even a sense of hope. Each person raked those trees with a fixity of expression.
Do you know what they're thinking?
You profess to read minds?
Those minds. They look at those trees and they think, there are 100 of us. That's what they think.
Why?
Those are date palms. One date palm requires 40 liters of water a day. A man requires but 8 liters. A palm, then, equals 5 men. There are 20 palms out there, 100 men.
But some of those people look at the trees hopefully.
They but hope some dates will fall. Except it's the wrong season.
We look at this place with too critical an eye. There's hope as well as danger here. The spice could make us rich. With a fat treasury, we can make this world into whatever we wish.
And she laughed silently at herself. Who am I trying to convince? The laugh broke through her restraints, emerging brittle, without humor.
But you can't buy security.
Yui turned away to hide his face from her. If only it were possible to hate these people instead of love them. In her manner, in many ways, Jessica was like his Wana. Yet that thought carried its own rigors, hardening him to his purpose. The ways of the Harkonnen cruelty were devious. Wana might not be dead. He had to be certain.
Do not worry for us, Wellington. The problem's ours, not yours.
She thinks I worry for her. He blinked back tears. And I do, of course. But I must stand before that black baron with his deed accomplished, and take my one chance to strike him where he is weakest, in his gloating moment. He sighed.
Would it disturb Paul if I looked in on him?
Not at all. I gave him a sedative.
He's taking the change well.
Except for getting a bit overtired. He's excited. But what 15-year-old wouldn't be under these circumstances? He's in here.